This is the Tech Talk for Accountants show with your host, Andrew Lassise, where every week we have a new guest to discuss the latest technology, apps, tips, and tricks to help you improve your accounting firm. This episode is brought to you by Tech for Accountants, an IT firm that specializes in cybersecurity for the small accounting firm. Many of our clients used to work at big firms that had all this crazy security and then went to work for themselves. And while they knew it was important to have great IT security, they just have too many other things to worry about and don't have enough time to actually learn this stuff. What we do is help bridge the gap so that even small accounting firms have great security at a fraction of the cost of doing it themselves, and it's all done for you. We offer listeners to the show a complimentary IT audit and consultation. Just go to tech4accountants.net/podcast. And you can book a free IT audit. Again, that's tech4accountants.net/podcast.
Recording and streaming. Wonderful. So we were discussing beforehand how I never forget to record. And we're here again, another episode of the Tech Talk for Accountants show. I'm your host, Andrew Lassise, with Tech for Accountants, IT specializing in the accounting industry. And it is my pleasure today to have Paul Hammond on the show. He's with RC Reports, and Paul's an expert in determining reasonable compensation for closely held business owners. He's educated more than 80,000 tax professionals and valuators on the topic of reasonable compensation and has been published in numerous national and state journals. So, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Andrew. I'm super excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a little while now.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you're among a good crowd, because I mean, basically everybody that's been on the show is a superstar, awesome person.
Absolutely.
Except for the episodes that don't get published.
So yeah, this one just continuing to build that credibility. I mean, we're just moving up. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think next on the list maybe would be some sort of like politician or someone just, you know, like maybe I could get like Michelle Obama to like share her story. She's probably next in line above Paul.
I would imagine. I don't see that too far of a stretch at all.
No. And I mean, I'm sure she's got something to give somebody somewhere. So Paul, reasonable compensation. Give us a little background on yourself and what kind of led you into, I'm sure as a kid, when they said, what do you want to be when you grow up? Were you thinking reasonable compensation in the tech space? Was that sort of where your head was at?
Almost. I was definitely thinking reasonable compensation. I wasn't sure it was going to be in the tech space at that point in time. I mean, look at me. There wasn't a tech space.
Yeah. Tech space was just like a giant mainframe, like a room with like some spinning tape and stuff.
So, I actually came from a background in small business, entrepreneurship. I spent a long time in compensation and executive search. And you and I were talking a little bit off air about the Great Recession. So the Great Recession, I had a little bit of time on my hands. I ended up doing some really specialized compensation planning called reasonable compensation for tax compliance issues with S-Corps. And it was lucrative, but it was frustrating. It was incredibly expensive. I was charging $2,000-$3,000 to a CPA who engaged me to produce a reasonable comp study, because the IRS was attacking that figure. And we talked a little bit more about the whys on that if you want. I was just frustrated. One, it was expensive. And two, I wasn't hugely confident with my conclusions because the data sets out there weren't all that reliable and credible. Quick fast forward button. A couple years later, I put together a team. I'm very relationship based, so I'd met a lot of people over the years. So I put together a team. We just looked into whether we could do this more economically and faster. We didn't know we were going to be a SaaS company at that time. We were just trying to solve the problem for maybe a few $100s rather than thousands of dollars and do it, you know, in less than 2 to 3 days. And so that's where RC Reports came from. Just came out of a need and a frustration that I personally had. And we founded in 2010. We released our first version in 2012, and we're celebrating our 10-year anniversary right now.
Oh, well, congratulations. 10 years, big deal. You know, they say the 11th is the hardest.
So you gotta. we're in that one. Thanks.
It's like, I remember when I started out. So you're a year ahead of me on this. So, or yeah. So your launch is 2012. So 2014 was our birthday. So like going into our 9.5 into 10 year. But like, I remember early on, I was like, man, once we do this, it's going to be easy. Once we get here, it's going to be easy. And it's like, I'm still waiting for it to get easy. Like, I'm more familiar with it now. There's the stress is just what I'm used to. Like, my watch will be like, hey, you're really stressed out. Like, you know, you should probably chill. And it's like, man, I'm just watching YouTube videos right now, not working hard. Like, I'm eating with my kids at a restaurant. Their four-year-old throwing a temper tantrum. And it's like, you're more stressed out dealing with a kid at dinner than you are at work. It must just be my new norm. So why is this topic, why should this matter? Okay, so you were saying people, the IRS goes after people, reasonable comp, and then you were basically doing like a consultant and research, and it was expensive. You weren't extremely confident in what the results you were presenting, but it was at least better than nothing. They could point to you, say they did their due diligence. This is the number we landed on. So you discover that you could do it cheaper, faster, better. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So we're moving into that realm, and we've run into some of that as we've grown our company as well, where this used to be super expensive to do this. And it's like, now we can just automate it and you can do it at a low price point and go quantity, scalability, focus efforts on marketing and less in the fulfillment space, things like that. So why does the IRS go after people on reasonable comp? What's sort of the background in that?
Yeah, so we started out by solving an examination issue, which was called a reasonable comp challenge. So this commonly comes up in S-corps, and that's, I think, we will probably keep our conversation today just to keep things simple. But S-corps are formed by a lot of businesses whose accountants or themselves may have not looked at the whole picture or may not have the best advice. So they'll become an S-corp because somewhere, somehow, they heard that if I'm an S-corp, I'll save on taxes. A pretty broad statement and not always true. We can get into a little bit about why that is, but it comes down to this. When you make money in an S-corp, you can take it out as wages and or distributions, right? So the less you take out in wages, the more you can take out in distributions, the less you'll pay in payroll taxes. And payroll taxes, we're just talking about your Social Security and Medicare, like 15.5% roughly, plus or minus, right? So what S-corps were doing is they were artificially keeping their reasonable compensation below what it should be. And we can talk about that definition if we want. And the IRS would come in and say, nope, I'm sorry, you've been paying yourself $24,000 a year. That's not enough. We're going to bump that up to 90. And then the taxpayer would then be paying payroll taxes, penalty, and interest on that difference between the two. It's really expensive. And so that's where we got into the field, because the IRS was pulling a number out of kind of thin air, not as thin air as most taxpayers. Most taxpayers just kind of look up, number appears to them, magic eight ball, crystal ball, whatever method they used, and that's what they used. But it wasn't defensible. It didn't have any grounding in reality. And the IRS knows that. That's the case most of the time. So when they knock on the door and ask where you got it, you don't have anything to back that number up, there's a good chance they may challenge it. And so that's where we came from. Where we are now is we still do a ton of that work. There's a ton of our of reasonable comp challenges happening again. They shot up from about 2008 through about 2014, and they dropped off kind of with the IRS's entire drop off all the way through the bottom of COVID, and now they're spiking again. But we also counsel with reasonable compensation in our software with entity planning. Do your entity planning correctly early on and know whether it makes sense to be an S-corp or not and what that payback looks like. And so that's part of our software as well. We'll do that analysis.
Yeah, and the entity you know, you touched on a lot of good points there. And so right in the beginning, you said, oh, someone got S Corp because they heard it'll save in taxes. And I see frequently, I try to keep away from the Facebook groups, especially when it has to do with things that are not tech related. You know, it's like they'll be asking for legal advice and people will be saying these things that are very, very, very like confident, matter of fact advice in something that they don't understand and know. And it's like, oh, well, how should I structure my company? And then some other person that doesn't know their situation says, my accountant said LLC file as S Corp. That is how you do it. And then, you know, a bunch of other people, I echo this, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, that's like that guy who, okay, I'm going to start my company. I'm going to build it to 9 figures and then have this wonderful exit and all this stuff. And it's like, oh, you know, if you did a C Corp, you would have saved ridiculous money in, and I forget what it's called, but where you're in a C Corp and then don't have to pay the tax on the exit. And it's like, if you had discussed that with someone that knew what they were talking about, they would have told you day one, all right, this is how you need to structure it because your goals are this. The way you're running it is like that, not because some person that doesn't know anything said, this was my experience. And a lot of people echo that. And I see it with legal advice and all stuff. And I'm just like, you guys get mad when people ask for tech advice, not from a tech person. How is this any different where you're asking legal advice from tech people? And I've, one of my best friends who I talk to almost every day, he is a lawyer. And so I'll see some of these things and just say, this is what everyone's saying. And I know that this is correct because they all say it with such confidence. He's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, but everyone says it with confidence. He's like, are they lawyers? So yeah, like you said, people will do it because other people tell them and their peers tell them that aren't experts, but you know, it's like you trust stuff from your peers and just sort of roll with it. Then we get into what's this reasonable compensation number? We just pull it out of thin air. We just say, this is the number. So let's take it. Okay. So the minimum wage example or 24,000, a little $12 an hour, right? So you're the head of the company paying yourself $12 an hour. You're doing several million a year. Okay. It's not accurate. So we bump it up a bit, say, okay, anyone would agree that that's just an outrageous number, but then put it in like a, okay, 90,000, right? It's a good living, good wage. It's probably not congruent with what the company is doing and the actual value that that person's bringing to the company. So is the IRS looking at just the, here's the ridiculous ones, get these ridiculous ones out of the way. It puts yourself at 90 and that's acceptable enough, or are they kind of looking, what are they looking for? And what would say in that scenario, 8-9 figures, but the compensation, owner comp, taking big distributions as well, way more than the compensation.
You touched on something that a lot of CPAs, EAs, and advisors are worried about, as well as business owners, which is throwing that red flag. I'm a big proponent of saying, don't worry about throwing the red flag. Just know if you have a defensible position for that. But if you throw a red flag because you don't have a defensible position, now you aren't likely to be in a battle. But I loved what you started off with, which is talk to an advisor. Talk to a very well-formed and educated advisor, because selecting an entity type isn't just about a quick Google search. There's a lot that goes into that. Most businesses, when they start out, are in some sort of a pass-through entity or sole proprietorship. But C-Corps do make sense. A lot more than they used to after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was passed. The reasonable compensation also comes into C-Corps. We usually are dealing with S-Corps, but it comes into play there as well. But with reasonable compensation, you had mentioned that, you know, people will see a post and other people will pile on and then they'll just begin to believe it. We have been asking for years now, the first polling question when we educate is what methods does the IR accept for determining reasonable compensation? And there's three massive myths out there. And then the last one's the real one, right? And consistently over the years, a few years ago, it was 20 to 25% of the people got it right, which means 70 to 80% of the people were misinformed. That number is now creeped up between 30 and 35% of the people are getting it right. So there's some progress being made, but that means that more than half of the professionals out there, the EAs and the CPAs, are misinformed on reasonable compensation. So we do an unbelievable amount of education in that space.
And this is a very serious topic that literally applies to so many businesses. I mean, this isn't just a, well, that only applies to, you know, if you're dealing with like a Fortune 500 company, or this only applies to a sole prop not making much money who's doing it as a hobby, but like a little more than a hobby. You know, this is like this applies to a giant chunk of business owners. So what are some of the myths that are out there? Actually, do you have off the top of your head the four, and then I'll give my stupid guess and then you'll tell me why I'm wrong?
Sure. So the first one is the 50-50 rule, split wages and distributions 50-50. The second one is industry rule. We'll set your wages as a percentage of profits or sales or some other industry benchmark. And then the last is safe harbor. Let's set it at the Social Security maximum, because really that's what we're talking about, are payroll taxes, right? So which of these three methods does the IRS accept? The fourth answer is all of the above. And the fifth answer is none of the above.
Ooh. So as you were saying them, I was thinking, okay, I could see that. I could see that. I could see that. So I'm going to guess that I say all of the above and you tell me the answer is none of the above.
And you are absolutely correct. And so that's the big myth, which is, I forget there's a term for it, but it's where you want the easy answer to be the truth, so you just adopt it as if it is, because the 50-50 rule takes seconds. I mean, if that. But what reasonable compensation is in its most simplest form, Andrew, in your company, if you had to step out of your company, you're taking a sabbatical because you're going to spend the entire year in Europe, what would it cost to hire somebody to come in and do all the same things you're doing?
$20 a month with ChatGPT. I am obsolete now.
And that might be, and that would be perfectly reasonable as long as we can back it up.
Yeah. But
it really is. We define it as replacement cost. What would it cost you to replace yourself in your company? And so there's some different approaches and analyses that need to take place to actually come up with that number. When you come up with that number, that's what gives you a defensible position. So if you get the knock on the door, where did you come up with 90,000? And you're like, this is how I do it. I do these things for my company. This is what the wages are in South Florida. And here you go. And so we've used the IRS's own methodologies. Our database is proprietary. It is the biggest one, private wage database in the country. And we have been through hundreds of comp challenges and used in litigation. And knock on wood, our data has always withstood.
All right. So your data always withstand. I always remember to click the record button on a podcast. So we're in the same spot of the 100% rule. So with RC reports, how is this structured? Is this like a one-off by the software and get the answer that you're looking for and then we're done? Is this SaaS ongoing to help all of your clients that need this? What does the model look like?
when we originally built the software, this is kind of a little bit of an aside, but version one never saw the light of day. We went out and we tested it, and it just didn't cut it. Because we had it more focused for business owners. And what we learned right away is this is not tech that should be in the hands of a business owner. Because knowing your reasonable compensation figure is only half the equation. Putting it into the context of the business scenario, which we talked about a little earlier, that is paramount. So we retooled the software to be a tool for advisors. If you work with small and medium-sized, closely held businesses, this is a tool you need to have, because whether or not you're working with S-Corps, if you're working with LLCs or you're working with Schedule Cs, as those companies grow up, doing the analysis as to whether they should become an S-Corp or not, you need to know their reasonable comp, and we have that analysis tool. So we've built this as a SaaS tool. So most of our users are on an annual plan or annual basis, but we do have the one-off option. If you need just one report for you, you've got only one client, you can do that as well. But most of our users are in there running reports for all of their S-Corps and their other SMBs, depending on what that analysis would be. And we very much encourage it. And most of our use now is proactive. When we launched, almost all of our use was reactive. People in trouble. People in trouble still use our software, right? Our database of wages goes all the way back to 2001. But we really like when people use our software for good, and they use their powers for good to really help a client.
Yeah. I know in our industry, the proactive versus the reactive, it's like the proactive clients tend to be, you know, this is general, but you know, the proactive ones that understand the importance of it, having it in place and presenting the value to their clients that they're taking care of this, as opposed to, hey, there's a 911 emergency. I've got to pick someone and I pick you. And God, I hope this is the right pick, but I don't have a choice. And it's like, it makes the sales cycle a lot easier when everything's on fire. And we've had people, actually just had someone earlier this week, where it is huge data breach and the FBI is investigating, and you know, we're playing the role in the forensics of how did this happen, what were they doing, what weren't they doing. And you know, it's like, it's great that we got the deal, but on the other side, it's like, it stinks to be in this position, because instead of like, hey Paul, it's great to start this relationship, here's what we can expect, and here's how to do this and how to do that. And ours is like, the FBI wants to know this laundry list of just everything. You guys can do this, right? It's like, yeah, we can. Let me get to work for you, master. It's like, oh, prices are a little different in the 911. So we prefer on the proactive, making sure that nothing happens. And if we have to lose a client, I'm happy to lose them on account of like, what do you do? Like nothing bad is happening. And it's like firing a security guard because you don't have crime. It's like, it's working.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And again, when accountants use their powers for good and can help clients, along those same lines, let's say you do have a company that's quite profitable and you are paying yourself $90,000 a year, but you've hired a rock star staff. What if you're only working part-time now? What if you're not doing all that much? You may be overpaying too. So we see that come up pretty regularly as well. It's like, oh, wow. You know, I wanted to set it high enough not to get the IRS's attention, but my client was actually overpaying, and now I'm saving them more money over here too. So we're a big proponent of the three bears, right? We don't want it to be too low. We also don't want it to be too high, although we don't see it happen very often. They will go after a reasonable comp that's too high as well. We want it to be accurate and just right.
So kind of that Goldilocks of reasonable comp, that'll be the next version. Goldilocks and the three versions of reasonable comp.
Goldilocks and the three accountants.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that scenario, I'm curious to dig into that. So 90,000 for a company that's very large, but their role is not that involved and could be replaced at a pretty, like, that 90,000 is not far-fetched whatsoever, if anything, on the high side. But the shareholder distributions are very high because the company is efficient and profitable, and why the owner doesn't have to have a ton of involvement. Would that still have to raise it up, or is that just a myth because your distributions don't play a role in that, but the replacement cost based on, and that's just industry average norms and what that replacement cost actually looks like. That is the, so it doesn't matter if you're paying 90, but you're taking something like a million out. It's not something that, it's not a relevant thing. Your distributions don't play a role in reasonable comp.
I won't say they don't play a role. They don't play a role in what your replacement cost would be. We could nerd out and get into where it does, but we won't right now. But that's where the anxiety comes from both business owners and from advisors, is that red flag. Wow, this company's making $1 million a year. I can't fathom this guy paying himself $55,000 a year. The IRS is going to come and they're going to, you know, they're going to come after us. You might not be wrong, but again, don't be afraid of throwing a red flag if you have a defensible position. All right. So, Andrew, I'm going to slot you into this very successful business. You've grown it. And in the early years, you were working 60, 80 hours a week, right? I mean, a lot of small business owners, right? 40 hours a week, that's their part-time number. But you've grown this business. You've surrounded yourself with really good people. And you're taking a little bit of a step back. You're only in the office, or you're only participating in the business about 20 hours a week, right? That needs to be taken into account. And then what are you doing, right? You've hired a CEO who's managing the business. So you're spending most of your time doing interviews, just like this, or out speaking on a lecture circuit, right? All right, well, let's figure out what we would cost to replace yourself and doing those two, wearing those two hats. Boom, it's $55,000 a year. It's defensible. This is what I do. IRS, we've met your definition. And I could bore you with the exact definition of reasonable comp from the IRS, but it's replacement cost, right?
So that's really interesting. And, you know, talking about the myths, and so I'm just getting like a free consultation right now, right? Like the names and numbers have been changed to protect the innocent, but the concept, though, that, I mean, I'm sure when my accountant sat down with me and calculated reasonable comp, and, you know, I'm a tech person, like the accountant said, this is reasonable comp. And I said, all right, I don't have anything to go against this other than, am I going to really do all of this research on my own to try to go head to head with someone that, in theory at least, should know more than me? But you're right. The misinformation that floats around, and, you know, a good example in the tech world, every tech person I've ever worked with that knows anything about tech, they just despise McAfee, right? Just everyone hates it. Yes, it comes with computers and people just buy it because it's right there and convenient. Everyone hates McAfee, and Norton doesn't do that great of a job either, but they're market leaders. People know what they are, right? You go on Amazon and McAfee's like the number one rated antivirus. And it's just like, who is doing, it's like, am I just, did I miss the, like, did they change something? Because what we see in our jobs as professionals is that this is terrible, horrible, nothing's changed. And that used to be the case for, like, Windows 7 had Microsoft Security Essentials, and that was pure garbage. And then I believe it changed in 8.0 8.1, 10, whenever they put out Windows Defender, is like a good alternative. And it's like, okay, the free built-in one is better than some of the paid for ones. And like, it changes over time. But the amount of misinformation, and I'll see in accountant groups, people asking, what's the best antivirus? And say, oh, I love McAfee. And it's like, you don't actually know. You took Amazon reviews from people that don't know what they're talking about, and you don't have anything to gauge it against. Like, tell me how many data breaches you've been protected against because you have, like, you can't because you don't understand the technical nuance. But everyone says it with such confidence, so it's hard to go against the grain when everyone raves about something that actually isn't what, like what the reality is. So working with an expert, especially like a narrowed, honed into expert, when you're trying to accomplish something. I know early on in my company career life, it was like, what can I pay the least amount of money for that will still get the job done? And then I've just sort of discovered over time that it's like, when it's important, I end up having to spend fixing costs or spending an extra time and energy in getting to the correct thing I should have done in the first place. And it's like, looking back, wouldn't I just rather have done it right to begin with? But it's hard to get out of that mindset. So do you recommend, so for the people that are working with you guys proactively, do you position this is a value add to your clients? You can put this in your service offerings, your package, ways that you can increase value? Or is it, hey, we're going to do an audit, check where you're at, call it a day? How do you guys sort of fit into that equation?
Yeah, so the fastest growing group of subscribers for us are the, I call them kind of the lifestyle advisory practices. And these are accountants that have, for lack of a better way of describing it, grown up over the last 10, 20 years. Maybe they worked at some of the big companies, maybe they worked with some smaller companies, but they're starting to go out on their own. Or they've been elevated to a point in their current firm where they need to look at this. And so they do look at this as an advisory add-on, predominantly for entity planning. But in addition to that, the risk of a reasonable comp challenge is incredibly expensive, not to mention their own professional liability when it comes to this, which hits in a few areas. But if your accountant just says, let's just use the 50-50 rule, which doesn't exist, right?
Let's use the old 50-50 rule. Not a thing.
Yeah, right?
Like, you said it with confidence, though, and I'm an accountant. Yes. 50-50 rule it is.
Yeah, you get challenged. You find out it isn't a thing, right? You're mad at your accountant. The accountant actually has some skin in the game here. Back in, I want to say, around 2013, 2014, somewhere in that time frame, the IRS began hitting tax preparers with preparer penalties on this for not addressing it. So they have their own risk in addition to the taxpayer. So they also use this as just kind of their, what I call their 1120S package. Look, we're doing this at least once a year. We're going to have this number on file, and that's what it is. And they just add it to their 1120S package. But what I find is most of these advisors just love that advisory role. Let's talk about whether you should be an S corp, or if you are an S corp and you shouldn't be, let's talk about that too, right? Because our software will tell you, you know, whether kind of how it pans out, right? It's important to say to that new business owner coming, my friend said I need to be an S corp. Let's be an S corp. Do that analysis. Say, hold on, not yet. Let's just let you be for a couple more years. But based on our projections, it looks like it'll make sense for you to make that S-Corp election in 2025, that type of thing.
And again, it just comes back to, this is why you have experts in specific fields, answering specific questions. And even if, okay, maybe it costs a little extra, you get the confidence that you're getting the correct answer. You know, it's like, oh, well, I have this brain injury and I went to a pediatrician and she said I was probably fine. It's like, but she doesn't deal with that on. It's like, yeah, but she's a doctor though. And it's like, yeah, like, you know, we it's easy to see it in that analogy and like healthcare because it's just ingrained into us that you go to a specialist for anything in healthcare. And same with legal, where no one's just, hey, I'm an attorney. Like, I guess you could be internal counsel, but in general, someone private practice, I'm an attorney. What do you do? Just all law, just any law that exists. That's my specialty, you know, personal injury and, you know, divorce and immigration. Yeah, estate planning. I just do everything. I am a lawyer after all. And so people are like, huh, he is a lawyer. But we don't always look at it in other professions, even though within our own profession, we know the nuanced differences, or maybe we don't, you know, in your world of, I've heard the 50-50 rule forever. And that makes sense. And when you said that, I was like, huh, 50-50 rule. That makes sense. It's not a rule. The 50-50 myth. Mythy, yes. Mythy. Yeah. There's probably some play in there.
So, but yeah, you're spot on with that. And so as far as our growth goes, it's just been significant over the last couple of years. And most of it is in that proactive advisory company. They're just the perfect fit for us. They want to help their clients. They want to do it right. They want to sleep at night knowing that they've got a defensible position. But the other people that find us overnight are the people that are in tax resolution, right? They're helping people. That's great. We have a great track record in that space as well. But the folks that we end up helping that I would love to move them into the proactive category. The best way I can describe this are nobody gets hit by the bus they see coming, right? I've been doing this 30, 40 years, never had a reasonable comp challenge, never been an issue. We'll just keep doing it the way I've always done it, which is we're just going to use 10% of gross revenue or whatever that number would be until they are the company that gets hit. And
then it's whoops.
It's not only whoops, but examiners are not uninformed and uneducated. Oh, 50-50 rule. That client's doing 50-50 split. Oh, and this one is too. Oh, look at this nice book of business. I'm going to work my way through because it's really efficient for me. And Eric Green has a story on this where an examiner had been doing it for 35 years, right? Nobody gets hit by the bus they see coming. They hit one of his clients, saw 12 others, did 2 years worth on every one of them. So that's 13 times two times $5,000 repair penalty. Long story short, he got hit with $130,000 in preparer penalties, not to mention what his clients got hit with. So although we're there, we can help. We can kind of be that voice of reason. It's still going to be costly. So we'd like to try and move as many people as possible into that proactive advisory category. So that when it comes, it's like, nope, we did exactly what you said, IRS. It's $55,000 because Andrew's living the life, man. He's got a great team making him money. To replace him, all we need is $20 and a subscription to ChatGPT.
I guess you would need a prompt engineer to know the words. I could give him the playbook. But even me, like right now, this is just AI right here. I wasn't supposed to do that. Andrew didn't prompt me to not do that. But, you know, I think the lesson to be learned here is that just because something is thrown around and said with confidence, it's never going to be a bad idea to speak with an expert and either get the confirmation that what everybody is saying is correct or become informed on the specific nuances. As I had shared with my best friend, the attorney who focuses on it's like insurance claims against construction companies, right? Knows that back and forth, anything. Also has a good understanding of the rest of the law, right? And I had asked him some very specific questions and he gave me very confident lawyery answers. And I still went to the super specialist attorney that said he is coming at it from this position. However, he is not correct because this very, very specific thing that had it not been addressed, because he wasn't an expert in this field, this is a gigantic issue. So we need to address this. And it's like, it could have gone either way. It would have been, okay, peace of mind, he was right. And, or the, it's like, which do I prefer, that he was wrong and I didn't spend money hearing something I already knew? Or, so, I mean, there's, I don't think there's ever going to be a downside to getting expert advice from an expert and learning, you know, that 50-50 rule is not a thing. And now I believe that with my own accountant, I think I've got like the 1120S package. And I think reasonable comp is in that package now that I think about it. Cause I remember seeing it and thinking like, well, that's dumb. That's not a thing. And after this conversation, it's like, I wonder how much he knows versus me now that I am an expert. 45 minutes on a podcast with Paul, and let me tell you as the expert, because I know three things that you don't, therefore I'm an expert. I'll go on Facebook and let everybody know I am perfect, almost as knowledgeable as Paul in this area. And Paul, I think it's a great point to leave off. I mean, I've learned a ton on this episode, and anyone listening, if you enjoyed it, be sure to like as well. Send the love to Paul. And Paul, where can people find more about you?
RCReports.com is a good place to start. And if you want to learn even more than that, jump on a demo. Our demo people are incredibly well-trained, and they're also super groovy, just like everybody else in our company. So we take what we do seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. So we really do enjoy having fun along the way. And I got to tell you, I had a blast today. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. And we'll see you in Chicago.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Paul, thank you for being on the show. And guys, if you enjoyed the show, be sure to like it and subscribe. And Paul, you have a great day. It was great having you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to the Tech Talk for Accountants show. I hope you enjoyed today's guest. And remember, you can go to tech4accountants.net/podcast to book a complimentary IT audit conducted by a technician certified by the AICPA in cybersecurity. Again, that's tech4accountants.net/podcast.